interlock the way they are in the plot and in the whole understanding of exchange, were elements that all came up and began to kind of stew around in my mind to make some kind of palatable soup out of it, because it really is, it's really a very complicated story, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if you had difficulty with it. How many of you have read it? Tell the truth and shame the devil. No, I wonder if you've gotten into it at all. Mm-hmm. You've read some of it? Mm-hmm. All right, well, I won't ask you how far you went. But I think it's important that you have read some of it, because then you realize the kind of twisted, complicated type of style that Williams uses. He uses a kind of a poetic, almost James Joycean style at times, because he, not that obscure, but certainly his use of words is, and his repetition of sounds makes you, they almost hypnotize you, so that you don't know what he's saying unless you go back over it again to really let what the words say drum into your mind their meanings. One of the problems with the book, and I think the book is filled with problems, and I think the reason that it's a good book is that in spite of it being filled with problems, it is a very, I don't know if you'd call it entertaining, but it does, grab you. It does keep you going, so that you want to keep on reading it if you, once you get into it. Now, I may say that there's no point there would be no point in teaching Charles Williams to a group of people who had no commitment to learning, because you don't read Charles Williams unless you want to apply some intelligence to it. If you're just going to read for escape for a little while and let it go at that, you'd never get through, you'd never get anywhere, you'd never get anything out of it. So the I assume your intelligence, and I hope it's not a false assumption, but along with intelligence, you do have to put a certain amount of energy into it. This is not a lazy man's book. Mm-hmm. None of Charles Williams's novels are for lazy people. You actually have to enter into it almost physically in order to get what he's saying and let it do something to you, you might say. The one of the problems of the book is the fact that there are all these parallel plots that go through it, and they touch upon each other in such strange ways, and you try to find the transitions and you try to find the meanings, and they don't make a clear picture. The reason for this is when you understand what Charles Williams means by the web of glory, the fact that life in Christendom, and he uses Christendom not in terms of just a sort of a generality of historical and geographical places, but Christendom meaning the kingdom under Christ, is a world that is well symbolized by a web in which there are many, many strings and threads that cross each other, and we're all here and there in it in a remarkable way. And although we don't always know where we touch each other or where we influence each other or where we are of use to one another, we are, because we are in the same web. And this kind of image allows you to have in a novel like this the plot that deals with Lawrence Wentworth, who is the historian, the professor who has gone, goes completely into the world of Gomorrah, or isolation of the self. And then you have the world of Pauline Anstruther, who is the young girl who has the doppelganger, you know, the girl who is the who has this fear of herself meeting her. You have the world of Adela and Hugh, and the kind of what we would say normal kind of people that live with their primal instincts that Dante talked about and paid no attention to the guardians of the threshold. And then you have all these people from other times. The man who hung himself in the house that Lawrence Wentworth eventually bought. And then the ancestor of Pauline, Anstruther, who has a who has the sacrifice of himself to go through, and we go through it with him. It happened 400 years before, you know. Now these are all, you know, you think, well, how do all these strings, you know, how can they possibly relate to one another? Well, they wouldn't if they were just hanging like this. But you see, they all are woven in a kind of an eternal pattern, you might say. But it's a much more living and moving thing than a pattern. We think of patterns as something that's put down and exact. But this is the web of glory is a much more ongoing and creative thing than our symbol of the pattern would be. It has a vitality to it that means that there is a possibility of change in it. Because if one person doesn't do what is expected of him, somebody else will. But there's also the possibility that that person may change, and in changing may drop out of the pattern into some really, you know, horrible abyss, which is what happens to Wentworth. The great thing about reading Descent into Hell after you've read Dante is that you see a number of relationships between the two. That the Descent into Hell is really the story of a man who is given chances not to go to hell, but who continually refuses to see those chances as possibilities. And as we said about the Inferno, which is embodied in the great refusal of man to live for the glory of God, this is what happens to Wentworth, in that he continually refuses to do the littlest, smallest things that would turn him away from this terrible nightmare that he has of the rope that pulls him down. You remember he has this dream at night that he's on this rope, and you know, this is very much like we read about in the Inferno, that these people are on this sliding scale, and all of them moving down more and more toward the center. The terrible thing about Wentworth is that although he dreams this and has this, you know, feeling of distaste, it isn't serious enough for him to really let it be a message to him from the other world. And so he goes along with it and allows all these little things to slip by him. Just as I said last night, the trouble with this man in this clock without faces, the clock without hands, realizes when he reads Kierkegaard that you could slide into eternity without ever having lived or known that you had refused to live. And this is a real shocker when you stop to hold it long enough to look at that kind of thought and think about it. How many of you have your books with you? All right, I'd like to have you look at the at some of these places in the how do you understand the person of Peter Stanhope in the story so far. Because no matter how, if you read two or three chapters, you would have an idea of him, I think. What do you think about Peter Stanhope? I mean, what kind of figure is he in the story?
He's a man who sees. He's got vision.
Yes, he's a man who sees. He certainly is a man of vision. What does he do for Pauline? Some of you must have read that far.
Yeah.
What is?
All right.
Then in a sense, what is he? What is he for Pauline, you might say?
I had written down that he was a savior.
Right, exactly. He's a Christ figure. You know, and we use that term a lot in when you start.
It's a hard term to say.
Oh, no, it isn't. I mean, the thing is, when you think of how lightly we use the term Christ, you know, I mean, we think it's okay to deal with him. Well, I'm not saying about you, Chris, but I mean, we do. Generally, people do use that term. That then we have to think in terms of that saying somebody is a Christ figure, that this is because we really do believe that if we are living as Charles Williams likes to put it, under the mercy and in the climate of forgiveness, that we then can be, and our obligation is to be Christ to one another. And Luther says this, you know, too. We don't have to go even to a good sound Episcopalian. We can go back to our old church father himself. Because, you know, he said we have to be little Christ to one another. And if you're going to be a little Christ to one another, this doesn't mean just opening your ear and nodding your head and saying, my, my, too bad, as I think I mentioned before. This is not what it means. Substituted love is not that kind of thing. And it's very clear in Descent into Hell what it meant to Peter Stanhope to bear the burden of Pauline. It was not something that was just a... Now you've told me about it. Don't you feel better? Well, you know, it was like pulling teeth to get her to say anything to him. And finally, when she says it, he says, I'm going to do something actual for you. I'm going to carry this. And she says, you can't do that. And anyway, I can't let you. And he says, oh, self-respect, is it? Well, he said, since when did you make the laws of the universe? Now, this is something that I think is important to realize in Charles Williams, that when you read him, you are really getting a good lesson in theology. Whether you like the theology or agree with it is another matter, but you are getting a lesson in theology, because from Charles Williams's interpretation, you and I do not make the laws of the universe, and that just because we think self-respect is of the ultimate importance, and that, you know, I'm too, you know, I should be able to carry my own burdens. You know, that's my business. I got to hold my head up and be strong and so on and so on. I mean, where we got this, I don't know, because it's not really, I mean, if Paul, St. Paul continually says, bear ye one another's burdens, and Jesus continually says, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. It doesn't sound as if this is supposed to be some kind of Superman theology that we're into, but you know, we all want to hold on to this. We'd like to be, we really would like to be Nietzschean and Nazis and be the strongest and the best. Well, let's see. I've got these marked, and then I didn't put, then instead of putting markers in, I just underlined it. So of course I have to sort through as I go. But there are a couple of things I wanted to mention before we went into the explanation of that substituted love and the way of exchange. On page 19.
Did you look up Zoroastrians?
Oh, I know Zoroastrians. Yeah. Zoroaster was the old great, one of the great Eastern founders of the Eastern religions that was really part of the sun worship, but much more involved in a kind of a philosophical aspect of the truth of life lived according to certain rites and certain proper functions according to his kind of interpretation of religion, but he had a belief in one God, and I meant to look up this poem of Shelley's, and I forgot it again. I get so busy thinking about the other that I forget about this poem. But I will look it up for tomorrow, so you get so you know what it's about, because I read it a long time ago and have absolutely, it's just like Periel. I can't remember what her name means, and I can't remember the general gist of this poem, except that I remember Zoroastrianism as one of the early religions of about the same time as the Old Testament fathers were developing their monotheism, and Zoroastrianism had a great deal had a monotheistic, strong monotheistic tendency, so that it had a little bit more positive element than the other religions of that surrounded the Jews. But Amagus is a magician, you know, like the old magi is the plural of it. On page 19, Mrs. Perry sighed, and everyone contemplated the problem again. And they're talking about the chorus, you know. And Mrs. Perry is such an interesting person in this story because, you know, she and the interesting thing is that Williams gives her a lot of credit. Says, you know, there's something about being efficient, something about having things done right. And I really respect him for that, because you do have a sense of there being a real people that take responsibility, even if they don't want to do it with imagination, at least you know things are going to get done, and it's not going to be sloppy. And people aren't going to say, oh, well, I had the right intention, but I just didn't get there on time, so, you know, nothing comes off. But, and Stanhope, whose play it is able to look at it with a lot of, you know, a lot of lightness and say, well, you know, at least she's going to get it done. We know she's going to get it done. Adela Hunt and Hugh Prescott discussed modernity between themselves. Pauline, lying back like Stanhope in her chair, was thinking of Stanhope's phrases, a different life, a terrible good, and wondering if they were related. If this chorus over which they were spending so much trouble were indeed an effort to shape in verse a good so alien as to be terrifying. She had never considered good as a thing of terror. And certainly she had not supposed a certain thing of terror in her own secret life as any possible good, nor now. Yet there had been an inhumanity in the great and moving lines of the chorus. She thought, with an anger generous in its origin but proud and narrow in its conclusion, that not many of the audience really cared for poetry or for Stanhope's poetry, perhaps none but she. He was a great poet, one of a very few. But what would he do if one evening he met himself coming up the drive? Doppelganger, the learned called it, which was no comfort.
And then she goes on to quote from Shelley, a poem of Shelley's, in which this it's like a little incantation inside of her that comes back to her and makes her fear all the more because of the mention of the dead child and the fact that he meets it in the garden. I think you should look on page 20 where Pauline is leaving. And I think you should notice the ways in which Williams drops all these little footprints of Christianity about in the book. Pauline really wanted to keep on talking to this. You know, when you're delaying something, how you will talk to somebody that you're even bored stiff with. You know, you don't want to talk to them any longer, but you hate to get on with what you're doing, so you keep on talking to them. And that's exactly what Pauline is doing with Myrtle. Myrtle is anything but interesting, but she just feels like, well, if she just could hold on to her a little longer, maybe then she just puts off the idea that she may run into this person of herself that she always meets or doesn't always meet, and that's what makes the problem. She never knows when. And Pauline was left to Myrtle's monologues on the comforting friendliness of sunsets. Even that had to stop when they reached the Fox's Hole. Myrtle, in a spasm of friendship for Mazias, or Mazias, however you want to call it. Williams never calls, very rarely names Christ by that name. He either calls him Messias, or he calls him a founder, or something not an expected term, and properly so, because he doesn't want you to get mixed up and think that this is just a regular old Sunday school tract that you run into, and he doesn't want, and a lot of people who read these are not Christians at all, not interested in it. And so then they are not going to be boggled by that, and still are going to well be caught in the bait of it eventually without their knowing it. As they parted upon the easy joke, Pauline felt the rest of the sentence pierce her. She took it to her with a sincerity of pain which almost excused the annexation. The Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. It was the cry of her loneliness and fear, and it meant nothing to her mind but the empty streets and that fear itself. She went on. Not to think, to think of something else, if she could. It was so hopeless. She was trying not to look ahead for fear she saw it, and also to look ahead for fear she was yielding to fear. She walked down the road quickly and firmly, remembering the many thousand times it had not come, but the visitation was increasing, growing nearer and clearer and more frequent. In her first 24 years, she had seen it 9 times. At first, she had tried to speak of it. She had been told when she was small not to be silly and not to be naughty. Once when she was adolescent, she had actually told her mother. Her mother was understanding in most things and knew it. But at this, the understanding had disappeared. Her eyes had become as sharp as when her husband, by breaking his arm, had spoiled a holiday in Spain, which she, for all their sakes, had planned. She had refused to speak any more to Pauline that day, and neither of them had ever quite forgiven the other. But in those days, the Cummings, as she still called them, had been rare. Since her parents had died and she had been sent to live with and look after her grandmother in Battle Hill, they had been more frequent, as if the hill was fortunate and favorable to apparitions beyond men, a haunt of alien life. Now this really, you know, is a clue to the kind of story you're going to get into. It's definitely going to have a lot more than meets the eye, and it's not going to be, well, it's not even going to be science fiction. There had been 9 in 2 years, that means that she must be 26, as many as in all the years before. She could not speak of it to her grandmother, who was too old, nor to anyone else, since she had never discovered any closeness of friendship. But what would happen when the thing that was she came up to her and spoke or touched? So far, it had always turned aside, down some turning, or even apparently into some house. She might have been deceived were it not for the chill in her blood. If someday it did not. And this is the sort of the lays the background of the kind of struggle that Pauline is into. Now, how crazy do you think that is? Have you ever heard of it before? Hmm? Anybody ever heard of it?
Well, fear myself is not uncommon to me at all.
No, that's right.
The way he has it described is not.
No, but fear, but it's true that there is a fear. Very often you have a doubleness in yourself that you're very much aware of, and this, although it doesn't take the actual concrete form, if it can be called concrete, of this doppelganger, it is a real threat to some people, and it sometimes is more or less throughout our lives. But for her, and for people who have this as a psychic problem, it is an actual, it's an actual visible manifestation. So that she really felt that what would happen to her is that she was going to go insane, or else she would commit suicide. She couldn't, she felt that this is what would happen to her at the end. So it was a dire kind of thing that she was into, and it was not a light thing. Yes, they call it the doppelganger. It is actually, see, see, somebody that's going twice, see, I'm coming this way, and that's coming toward me. So you see, you're twice going. And it's really an odd, very odd thing, but it does happen to people. It's an actual
phenomenon. So many psychologists would
be. Yeah, it's an actual phenomenon. It's not just something that Williams has set up in order to give a, to put it into some kind of story or fiction perspective. No, it's a real possibility, but let's hope you don't have to go through it. However,
is that considered schizophrenia?
Well, somewhat, I imagine, but it doesn't always, it doesn't always manifest itself in this form.
At this point, I didn't know we were sure that she was thinking it was herself again,
but
just footsteps.
Well, she has seen herself coming. See, whenever she hears footsteps, she thinks it must be, this is what it's going to be, whatever it is. It's going to be this person that looks exactly like her. Mm-hmm. Now that it's very easy to get mixed up on this, because there are footsteps all through this whole book, and whose footsteps, Wentworth hears footsteps, and the grandmother hears footsteps, and the man that hung himself hears footsteps, and he is some of the footsteps, so that there are continually the sound of footsteps going in and out. So it's very hard to know which is which, and that's why I say you almost have to go back and untangle it periodically to be sure that you know which is which. But whenever she, for instance, I don't know if you've ever been this frightened, but I know I've been terribly frightened of things sometimes, and I've had to go someplace all alone, and I've been in a place that really scares me. And she says, it says here, a maid came out of a house a little farther down a road and crossed the pavement to a pillar box. Pauline, in the first glance, felt the sickness at her heart. Relieved, she reacted into the admission that she was only 23 houses away from home. And I used to do that. I'd count how many posts or how many this or how many that before I got to where I knew I was safe. I mean, some of you have never been scared, but believe me, I have. She knew every one of them. She had not avoided so much measurement of danger. It had never appeared to her indoors, not even on the hill, which seemed to be so convenient for it. Sometimes she longed always to stay indoors. It could not be done. Nor would she do it. She drove herself out. But the front door was still a goal and a protection. She always seemed to herself to crouch and cling before she left it, coveting the peace which everyone but she had. 21. 20. She would not run. She would not keep her eyes on the pavement. She would walk steadily forward, head up and eyes before her. And I said, this is such a marvelous description. Mm-hmm. I mean, you hear somebody behind you, and you don't want them to think for 1 minute that you are at all bothered by the fact that you hear somebody. And if you slow down, they slow down, and then you go faster and they go faster. And she walked steadily forward, 17, 16. She would think of something, of Peter Stanhope's play, a terrible good. The whole world was for her a canvas printed with unreal figures, a curtain apt to roll up at any moment on one real figure. But this afternoon, under the stress of the verse, and then under the shock of Stanhope's energetic speech, she had fractionally wondered, a play, was there a play? A play even that was known by some, and then, not without peace, 10, 9, the mag of Zoroaster. Perhaps Zoroaster had not been frightened. Perhaps if any of the great, if Caesar had met his own shape in Rome, or even Shelley, was there any tale of any who had 6, 5, 4? Her heart sprang. There, a good way off, thanks to a merciful God, it was. Materialized from nowhere in a moment. She knew it at once, however far. Her own young figure, her own walk, her own dress and hat. Had not her first sight of it been attracted so? Changing, growing, was coming up at her pace. Doppelganger, doppelganger. Her control began to give, too. She didn't run, lest it should, nor did it. If it should be running very fast up the road behind her now. She was biting back the scream and fumbling for her key. And this is another thing, you know, how do you know you're going to get your key out? Quiet, quiet, a terrible good. She got the key into the keyhole. She would not look back. Would it click the gate or not? The door opened, and she was in, and the door banged behind her. She all but leaned against it, but only the doppelganger might be leaning similarly on the other side. She went forward, her hand at her throat, up the stairs to her room, desiring, and with every atom of energy left, denying that her desire could be vain, that there should be left to her still this one refuge in which she might find shelter. I mean, this is the kind of depth of fear that she's in. And this is what Peter Stanhope is going to take from her. Because, you see, she has not met the doppelganger. That's not what is the problem. Do you know what the problem is? Her fear is her problem. You see, I mean, the doppelganger couldn't really hurt her, could it? I mean, if it was exactly like herself. But it's her fear of it. And this is what Peter Stanhope does, you see. He says, you know, I can't take that from you, but I can take your fear. Well, now you see that, you know, the real, really weird.
Mary, I've been thinking about three things.
All right.
First of all, Mrs. Perry,
uh-huh.
Think about Tom.
No, sometimes he's efficient. He's not always efficient.
But, and then I think about, the name that Charles Williams gives his characters.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he names them on a whim, because every time I come across a new name, it's fitting the personality so closely.
Uh-huh.
I can't separate. When I picture Pauline, I just go, wow, you know, it couldn't be any other name.
No, he names them not on a whim, but on a specific plan in mind. He really plans the name of each person so that it fits, you know, really fits them. Stanhope, Stanhope, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get any feeling of that there's any light casualness about Peter. And you know, the word Peter meant the rock.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have
Wentworth.
Wentworth. All it's worth. I don't know how far you can pull these things, but actually, I don't. I thought about this. About this funny little lady, Mrs. Smile.
Yeah.
I decided her name must be either Simile or Smile or Smiley. I didn't know exactly how you pronounced it, but she's a weird. Well, she's another one.
Wait, there's one more thing.
Yeah.
Battle Hill. I can't figure out the
significance
of Battle Hill. What it is. I've never been to Britain.
No.
I don't understand.
Well, the name Battle Hill is based on the fact that there had been battles there during the time of the War of the Roses and some other wars, I suppose, so that it was like, you know, like Bunker Hill or Gettysburg or...
Was it kind of a name?
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you see, it had been built into a suburb. It was all like Leavenworth has been built up, you know. It's not really a suburb of Wenatchee, but it's near Wenatchee. And Battle Hill was farther from London than that, but it was close enough to be related to it. But the name Battle Hill is quite significant. If you stop and think of the things that happened on that in that particular suburb, you know, during the few days and centuries that this book covers, you know, there are real, what are some of the battles that take place there? There's a battle between Pauline and herself and her fears, and Peter Stanhope's battle with her to gain her confidence so that she will give up her fear to him, and then her subsequent battles with her fear later when she has to go and meet her ancestor, you know. And then what other battles are there?
Wentworth
and Adela and Wentworth and who else?
Hugh
and Wentworth and Aston Moffat. Although that isn't an actual one, but it's there. And Wentworth against himself and his own desires and he loses that battle. Some battles are lost very definitely to the devil, and some of them are won over against him. But there's a continual strife going on here. It isn't as if everything were preordained and predestined to be put down in just any old way. There's a real struggle, and you're not sure how they're going to come out of it. So you have a real, now what about the attempt of this Mrs. Smiley to get around? There's a battle involved there too, because she's continually working her strategies to try to gain entrance to Pauline and to Adela, and she wins over Adela for a while. We don't know exactly how she's going to come out.
She also, it's her tactics that win over Wentworth, even though they're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems
same kind of thing.
What she
symbolizes.
Yeah, is what gets Wentworth, you know,
right.
No pain, no.
Well,
and
exactly.
For anybody you don't want.
Right. And allowing to live for yourself completely.
Mm-hmm. And just into yourself.
Mm-hmm.
She was talking about being into yourself.
Right.
He did that.
Mm-hmm.
He did his own.
Exactly.
Other half.
Mhm. Mhm. Yes, he did. So that, you see, Battle Hill is a good name for that little town. It's not a place of peace and satisfaction for everybody. But what does Pauline calls Stanhope her peace? She every once in a while, you know, when he says go in peace, she says he tells her now you say that to me, or you say go with God, and she says I can't because you're my peace. I don't have any. And he says say it anyway, and she finally gets it out, you know. She's able to just barely say it, but by saying it she has a certain sense of strength that comes to her even in the saying of it. There's something about objectifying some things that makes a big difference.
That's a really good description too.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Because I should have.
That's very. It's very good. And the I think this I just want to this chapter 2, We Immortus, the way of death, which is the problem, you remember, of the little workman that finally decides to hang himself. on page 26, this unskilled assistant had been carelessly taken on. He was hungry, he was ill, he was clumsy and slow. His name no one troubled to know. He shambled among the rest, their humorous butt. He was used to that. All his life he had been the butt of the world, generally of an unkind world. He had been repeatedly flung into the gutter by the turn of a hand in New York or Paris, and had been always trying to scramble out of it again. Now...
They're going to have fire trouble, you know that?
No.
Yeah.
Right now?
I guess there's some demons that are against us doing anything with this gang, or we're up to these...